I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The narration of segregation has often been reduced to just a chapter in history books. A bus tour in Kansas City is rectifying this by giving high school students an alternative way to understand social justice. Today, shedding light on structural racism in Kansas City and Johnson County. Hear what Race Project KC is doing to connect teenagers with the history of segregation in the metro. Then, Missouri once had 15 million acres of prairie. An advocate working to preserve that landscape explains the importance of saving the remaining 63,000. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. One lesson that doesn't always get covered in high school history classes in Kansas City is the story of the structural racism that's baked into the culture of our town and Johnson County as well. The Johnson County Public Library is attempting to address this through something called Race Project KC, which is an annual focus that immerses students in the realities of Kansas City, past and present. Race Project KC is aimed at students in grades 9 through 12. It includes a bus tour and other sessions aimed at pulling back the curtain on one of the bleaker legacies of our collective past. The project builds off of Tanner Colby's important book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, and Tanner takes part in the project each year. Now a conversation about this project and how kids who engage with it are reacting to it. With us, Tanner Colby, again, the author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black. He was also the host of the podcast, Our National Conversation, about conversations about race. Tanner, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Good to be here.
Angel Tucker is the Johnson County Library Youth Services Manager. Angel, good morning to you. Good to have you back.
Good morning.
Olive Henry is a Shawnee Mission East junior who has been on the bus tour. Olive, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hey, this experience has opened your eyes, Olive, and I'm wondering how.
Yeah, it's really interesting to go on the bus tour for the first time, especially growing up in Kansas City, specifically in Johnson County, and going to Shawnee Mission East, and sort of you're not aware of any of these things until you go on the bus tour. And so it was really fascinating to be a part of that experience and getting to actually see that and learn about that, which is something that we just don't have access to in school.
I was going to say, what's the difference between reading about it and then actually going out and seeing it with your own eyes?
Yeah, so I actually didn't read the book until after I had been on the bus tour, but I think that one thing that is really different about the book and the bus tour is that you can see the stark contrast, like actually when you cross streets like Troost and the Paseo, and you can, if you're listening to like the audio tour for the bus tour, it's not just that you're getting information about these divides, but you can see them in action.
Yeah, what was your emotional response to seeing that with your own eyes? What were you thinking as you were traveling through some of those neighborhoods?
I was, you know, it's really like quite tragic and kind of shameful that these things aren't taught. It was really eye-opening, and just to think about that, you know, if I hadn't like voluntarily been a part of that, I never would have known any of those things. And so to think that there are kids at our school who could really benefit from that experience and just like will never find out about that unless they read the book or go on the bus tour.
I was going to say, Angel, you know, saying that it's shameful that these things aren't taught, that's exactly what you're trying to straighten out here.
Yeah, and you know, Johnson County Library, one of our core missions is to nurture the collective knowledge of our community. And so this project allows us to up in front, put this information out into the community. And it, in my mind, changes minds and then changes lives and hopefully, in a sense, changes our overall community.
Where did the idea of the bus tour come from? How did that idea get started at the library?
It originated with Tanner Colby visiting our library in 2014. And in a library, generally, an author comes in, you have an event, signs books, and it's done. But educators in the audience were just taken aback by this history. I mean, teachers that are teaching history in high schools did not know this information. And so we held a teacher summit, and we brought teachers together from all over the city, every school district, and it became clear that they wanted their students to understand this, but that they didn't know how to do it and how to connect. And so the library, we were able to thread them together and build these conversations and support their efforts to become a broader community.
You know, Tanner, I'm not really sure what to make of this idea that even history teachers, they might know about the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, these broad macro conflicts that have engulfed our country over so many years. But history right in their backyard was proving elusive to them. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's definitely true. I was a 20th century American history major at Tulane University, which is not an inexpensive school. And I had never heard of these things until I was 30 years old and I sat down to start to write about them. And you know, part of it is the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, these types of things, slavery. You can't ignore that. But the history of real estate is very much buried in the ground. And so you can't ignore it if you choose to. And so we had just not taught this in schools ever. And because schools, you know, the book teaches the history of real estate segregation. And schools, public schools, have kind of ceased to be public in the sense that they are rooted in these neighborhoods that are privately owned. So if you were in a majority white, high property tax area, that's essentially a private school. We call it a public school, but legally we've essentially made it a private school. And so that school is going to teach the history that it wants to teach. And each school is very siloed in what it's teaching, which is why the library was key, because the library is the public institution that can reach into all these semi-privatized public schools and bring them all together and unite them in a single conversation. And so the fact that we don't teach this history is not surprising, because it's the part of our history that we don't want to know, we don't want to talk about. But I find, particularly as a white person revisiting this, and I think this is what Angel has really done with the program that's effective, is we approach the history of race as, particularly for white audiences, as like, you know, you need to do your homework, you need to eat your vegetables, and this is something you have to do for black people, for someone else to right a historical wrong that was done to them. When the fact is, this is everyone's history. This is how we got here, this is how I got here, how you got here. And I was fascinated when Obama won. It was clear that no one had any idea how we got from 1968 to 2008. Every TV pundit you saw on cable news was like, I don't know, how did this happen? And so it was clear to me that what was clear to me was that it wasn't clear, was that I didn't know. And so I wanted to know the history of how I got from where my parents raised me in the 60s and the 70s to here. And so I went and looked at the history of all the schools and neighborhoods that I had come from. And that, I think, is the great thing about this program, is that it teaches kids where they come from so that they know where they're going.
I was
going to
say, Al, what strikes me about this history is it's so totally, entirely relevant to today. It explains why we live where we live, why certain folks of certain skin colors live where they live. This is not something from the distant past. It's what we're living right now. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, especially because, like, you know, I had these questions growing up, and it's like, why is the only other, like, black man I know my own dad? And then all of a sudden, but, you know, I didn't really, like, think to question any of that. And then all of a sudden, I'm, like, in high school, and there's 30 black kids at my school, and I become a part of Race Project KC, and these things all start to click, and they all start to make sense. And it's not
30 black students in the entire population of Shawnee Mission East, which is like, what, 1,500 kids or something?
There's less than a percentage of black people at our school.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, like, there's an explanation for these things, and people have no idea how sheltered they are, and they have no idea that it's because of policy and it's because of this real estate development and, like, things that should be taught, because they're affecting how you grow up, who you go to school with, like, who your teachers are, all of this stuff that shapes who you are as a person and your decision making. And so I think that it is very relevant. And so that was a real emotional connection for
me.
You
know, one of the things that Tanner talks about so effectively in his book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, is this idea of racial covenants, meaning people of certain skin colors couldn't live in certain neighborhoods back in the day when these neighborhoods were developed by folks like J.C. Nichols. When you first heard about that, I'm wondering, someone of your generation, what went through your mind?
It was definitely very shocking, but also, like I said, it started to connect a lot of dots. You know,
right.
It was something that I never would have imagined, but after hearing it, it was like a light went off. I was like, oh, this makes so much sense, actually. Yes. And so to live like three streets away from houses where the deeds actually still contain the words that yes. people of color can't live there, even though you can't legally enforce that, like that has a lot of effect on not just the people of color in my community, but everybody in my community who's yeah. affected by that when it was legally enforced.
Angel, I was curious about the reaction that the library has received in the wake of offering this program. What are you hearing from residents and patrons?
You know, we get constant emails of schools that want to be involved in this program. And where we're at is how to sustain it and what role the library should continue to play. Because honestly, this is a program and an initiative that should belong to this city, the metro, in its entirety. It should include Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, Kansas City, Kansas Public Library, and there should be some sort of program in place where we can integrate in these spaces, because we can't integrate in our schools. Like Olive said, it's Shawnee Mission East is 0.8% Black. You know, 6 miles away at Wyandotte High School, it's 70% Latinx. At Paseo High School, it's 70% Black. And so because we have to just understand the fact of the reality is integrating in our schools will not happen. And so as a city, we need to come together. And I think we're seeing that with the mayor's initiative, with the Nelson bringing in 30 Americans this June to celebrate African Americans. We need to continue the conversation.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're suggesting that this program needs to go far beyond just high school students. This could be a program that even old folks like me might benefit from.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The other piece is elementary school students. We had a workshop with our high school students in February, a Mecca challenge, and they were given the task to how would you dismantle systematic racism? And one of the things that many of the groups talked about was we need to be talking to third graders about this. And there are some people in this city that are doing it. Katie Klein is doing it through a program, but it needs to be done more holistically.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about an initiative of the Johnson County Public Library called Race Project KC. It's based on a terrific book that Tanner Colby wrote a few years ago called Some of My Best Friends Are Black, that details some of the racial real estate segregation baked into the cake of Kansas City. Tanner, I'm going to ask you just an impossible question here, but can you summarize some of the major findings of your book so that our listeners are on the same page with us as we talk about racial covenants and the role of J.C. Nichols? What did your book attempt to sort of outline here?
Well, the book really was an attempt to, it started with the question, and that's why the book is called Some of My Best Friends Are Black. It started with the question that came to me in 2008, where I was this huge Barack Obama fan rooting for America's first black president. But I realized one day that I just didn't know any black people.
You didn't have any. You weren't in their homes. You weren't visiting with them.
Right. And I started asking all my white friends, like, have you ever been to a black person's house? And it was like, crickets, you know? And so I was like, okay. And these are all big Obama voters. And so I realized then in 2008 that this maybe wasn't entirely the hope and change moment that we thought it was. It was going to be definitely a catalyst to break things open, but I wanted to understand why. So I went back and looked at just areas of the public square that everyone belongs to. You can look at integration in, professional sports or music or that sort of thing, but I wanted to look at schools, neighborhoods, the workplace, and church, because those are four things that generally everyone belongs to. And why 40 years later, even if they weren't still legally segregated, they were still de facto segregated. And why the policies of school busing and fair housing and affirmative action had only made very limited gains. And so basically, as far as Kansas City is concerned, when the Supreme Court outlawed segregation in schools, they said, you have to root out segregation root and branch. And the fundamental thing there is that schools are just the branches and the roots are in the real estate. And so I went to look back at sort of the foundational thing of how we got here, which is that in the South, Jim Crow was the law. You had certain cultural norms and certain legal strictures that said white people had to be here and black people had to be here. But in the South, you have very small towns, so black people and white people are in relative proximity anyway. But when you came north into these big cities where you had large populations of black people coming north and west during the Great Migration, you had to come up with a mechanism to keep black and white people separate. And what J.C. Nichols did here in Kansas City is that he created a financial tool, this racial covenant, where now segregation was something you could buy and you could invest your money in. You
made certain it. Neighborhoods were going to be just all white,
right? Yeah. And you could and
it
so
was built that way, yeah,
right. And so now, not only is segregation your cultural way of life and your psychological way of life, it's what you've invested your life savings in. Most people, their houses, that most of what they own, and so that makes residential segregation the single hardest piece of this to grapple with. When Martin Luther King, after all of his, you know, victories and progress in the South, he went to Chicago to protest housing segregation and faced the worst defeat to that day, to that point of his career. And he went back to Alabama and said, people from the South need to go to Chicago to learn how to hate. Because when you try and take away that asset, that financial and physical asset that people have invested in segregation, that's when it gets really, really, really hard. So that's sort of like the main thrust of the book. As far as the Kansas City piece of it goes, and then as far as schools and workplace and church, there's it looks at just all the right. other dynamics that are at play.
You know, one to go one step further in the story of Kansas City, you talk about this practice here in town where, you know, white folks would be living in certain neighborhoods and then a house would go up for sale and maybe a black person would buy it. And the panic that would ensue, sort of engendered by real estate agents who were very intentionally trying to get white folks to flee out and buy real estate somewhere else. Tell us about that.
Well, so you had these neighborhoods. So you had the J.C. Nichol neighborhoods west of Troost who were protected by racial covenants and also just protected by politicians and by power that said, all right, when black people want to move out of 18th and Vine, we're going to steer them east of Troost and not west of Troost and protect the upper middle class white people. So you had working class white people who now are going to bear the brunt of this.
This was sort of a tacit agreement among real estate
agents,
agreement. Right?
Yeah, right. Sort of like a, you know... Everyone got together and said, all right, this is how we're going to do it. And so you had these real estate agents who were driving black migration south and east, and they would go into white working class neighborhoods where, say, a house was worth $10,000 at the time. And they would buy a house and rent it to a black family and then go around and use scare tactics to get everyone out, saying black people are coming and the real estate values are going to plummet. And so the first people, white people, to get out might get $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 for their house. If you were the last white person to leave, you might get $3,000 for your house.
Yeah.
And so that it just they just swept and ate the Lower East, not the Lower East Side, that's New York City, but east of Troost, and created this problem.
And this situation was replicated in cities all across the country.
Right. So what happened, J.C. Nichol pioneered this in here in Kansas City, but then J.C. Nichol was also a key advisor to Franklin Roosevelt. And when Franklin Roosevelt wanted to create a federal housing policy to boost construction and get the nation out of the Great Depression, he went to his friend J.C. Nichol and said, what are some sound real estate practices? And J.C. Nichol says, well, here's how you do it.
Yeah.
And J.C. Nichol, and also, and there's also, not to put it all on J.C. Nichol, there's a J.C. Nichol in every city in America. And they were all friends, and they all had a network, and they all shared best practices, you know, to them.
Yeah.
And that was, to me, the interesting link is that I grew up in Birmingham, and the J.C. Nichol of Birmingham and the J.C. Nichol of Kansas City were best friends, and they would exchange, you know, ideas and, you know, contracts right down to the deed.
And those were some of the ideas that got swapped around. Right. Okay, Race Project KC is our topic. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. If you want to join our conversation or tweet us at KCUR up to date, let's go to some phone calls. And Marlene from Prairie Village. Marlene, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that at the time that blacks were discriminated against, so were Jewish people. They couldn't live in Leawood. And I believe Lake Quivira had a ban on them also. And I think that needs to be pointed out that discrimination covers a lot of things.
Well, what neighborhoods did Jewish folks live in, Marlene? Where did they congregate?
They lived around, I think, around between Prospect and Troost, like 23rd, 24th. I don't know what that neighborhood is called.
Yeah. Right. No, it was definitely part of there was a when the whole idea of racial covenants were being discussed. It was very much on a sliding scale. It was definitely no black people, but then, you know, do you include Jewish people? What kind of Jewish people? What kind of Jewish people are acceptable? What kind are not? And, you know, Asian people, and so on down the line. And so there were different. It was practiced differently everywhere, but the bottom line was no black, and then no Jewish, no Asian, no Hispanic would be by different scales in different areas.
I'm glad you called, Marlene. Thank you.
Okay.
You know, this idea that we separate ourselves, at least historically, and maybe, you know, still to this day, Olive, give me some hope here, because I'm getting a little down. How's your generation going to be different?
Yeah, I think one way that we can see the change through Race Project KC is that when given the opportunity to engage with other people in other communities, we students do not shy away from that. So I think that a lot of this is sort of blamed on like the inevitability of racism and things like that. But there is in students who have the opportunity to engage with other people and to experience this and to understand why their lives are the way they are, why they're only able to engage with the demographics they engage with. Once they have that knowledge, they sort of become more aware, and they're much like we are very willing to sort of break down those barriers and engage with other people and, mm-hmm. and not sort of stay true to those dividing lines that have been shaped by real estate and J.C. Nichols.
Angel, do you share some of the same optimism as you work with young folks like Olive?
Absolutely. You know, Empathy comes from just knowing one person that's different than you are, whether it's race, ethnicity, religion. And so when I see these young people together, you know, connecting, talking, finding out all the things they have in common, it leaves me very hopeful.
Yeah. Let me go back to some phone calls here. And Linda from Kansas City, Missouri, our number 816-235-2888. Linda, you're on the air.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. I think you've had him on the program before, but Whitney Terrell's King of Kings County certainly deals with the history of blockbusting in Kansas City and relates it to the development of the interstate highway system, which made it easy to move to Johnson County.
That's Whitney Terrell's book. He's one of my colleagues at UMKC. His book, King of Kings County. I can't recommend it enough either, Linda. That's a really good recommendation.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Let's go to Richard from the east side of Kansas City. Richard, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve. It's Richard Tolbert calling.
Hey, Richard.
I've read the book that your guest wrote, and it's very good, I think, at explaining how things used to be. One of the best I've read, but in listening to the young people today on your show, I got the impression that they don't realize that that was then, but this is now. And since the bad things of the past happened, Martin Luther King Jr. led a civil rights movement that we won, and that black people have civil rights now. Therefore, the conditions are not as they were. And I think it's the Black Lives Matter thing that's getting sort of blown out of hand. You know, they have two big arguments. One is that white cops are killing black youth, murdering black youth. That's the way they put it. The other big argument they have, though, is that black people in America are horribly oppressed today. And I don't believe black people in America are horribly oppressed. We're living with the after effects of those decades of segregation, of course. But we won the civil rights struggle under Martin Luther King Jr. And therefore, I think we need to not dwell so much on the past and recognize what we need to do to clean up the after effects.
Tanner Colby, respond, if you would, to Richard.
Well, I would say that, yes, of course, much progress was made in the 1960s, and in terms of civil rights, many advances were made. But in terms of economic rights and economic equality, that's not necessarily true. And one thing that, when you look at how we solved this problem, how the frustration at the end of the 1960s with the riots and society feeling like it was coming apart, the Nixon administration, the way that they fixed it is they didn't take the color line down, they just made the color line porous. And so, yes, there have been many, many opportunities for many black people. Affirmative action put billions of dollars in black Americans' wallets, there's no question of that. And many black people did make it across the color line and into a place where they can do better. But when you look, the quickest way to summarize it is to say that, yes, it's getting better where it's getting better, but it's actually getting worse where it's getting worse. And so if you were part of black America that got access to the benefits of the civil rights movement, then yes, life is much better. If you were not, if you were still stranded on the other side of those institutional barriers of housing projects and segregation and failing schools, then it's not getting better at all. And in fact, the fact that it has gotten better for a percentage of black Americans is often used as an excuse to say, well, that the problem is over, when in fact the dichotomy there should show us how we failed in the 1960s, in the sense that yes, we won a few victories, but we're using those victories to ignore the fact that we failed to solve the real problem.
Richard?
Well, Tanner, let me just say this in reply. Two major things are different now. Number one, we have jobs now. In the 60s, most jobs a black person didn't even need to apply for. Today, that's not true anymore. There are jobs, and we have access to education still. So I don't buy this argument that we can't make economic progress, too. It's a slower process.
Right.
Okay. Well, I would say two things. One is that if you look at the wealth disparity, in large part due to real estate, the average black household in America has 5% of the net worth of the average white household. 5%.
5%.
5%. That number may be wrong. That's from a few years ago, but it's about that. And so if you look at my ability to finance college education, my ability to rely on my parents for a leg up, there's no contest there. The other thing I would say is that, you know, in the wake of the civil rights movement, you know, you did have a black backlash to integration as well, where you had black people cross the color line and feel disrespected and unwanted. And they said, all right, well, screw this. We'll go back to our side of the color line where at least we're in control of our own destiny. And so you had a strong contingent of the black community say, all right, well, we don't want to assimilate and integrate with white people. We just want access to resources, material resources. Mm-hmm. And the problem there is that white people are the resources in terms of social capital and access to knowing the right people to navigate institutions of power, to get into radio or politics or anything else. And so the fact that we are still so socially segregated is a huge barrier. In fact, if you look, I'd love for someone to do a scientific study of this because I only did an anecdotal study of it. But in the areas of industry where I looked, when I looked at black people who were successful across the color line in white America and black people who were either not successful or were successful in a black-owned business serving the black community, the difference was in their Facebook social networks, in that the black people who are successful across the color line have a bounty of white social capital available to them. And the black people who are not don't. And their social networks are 90%, 95% black.
Richard, I'm glad you called in. Thank you. Pastor Blunt from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I just want to address the author because I really delved into his knowledge. I've already been where he's at because I've seen this over time. And so now I have a solution to the problem is that we take a percentage of the tax base, reinvest it in the homes in the black on the east side of Kansas City, give these homeowners tax-free grants to repair their homes, to build their homes up until they reach the economic equity of those on the west side of the freeway.
That's a really interesting idea. Are reparations taking place anywhere in this country right now to the level that Pastor Blunt's talking about?
Well, I mean, you can look at affirmative action as kind of a nickel and dime form of reparations, not really that substantial.
We're doing a 1/8-cent sales tax for the east side now, which is, again, a small step.
Right. And so you can do that kind of material reparation and there are debates by people far more qualified than I about how effective it is. My question is always about the social and cultural reparations of how we forge relationships across the color line, how we reparate white people who don't know what the hell is going on half the time, and how do you fix, you know, giving money to black people on the east side doesn't change the lack of education among white people that you need for black people to be able to enter white America. So that's my larger question.
You know, Angel, before we leave this segment, tell us a little more about Race Project KC, how people can connect to it. There's a bus tour involved, a self-guided bus tour we've talked about on this show before, but just walk us through some of the different components here.
So we have an app called Dividing Lines, and you can take that on your own. It's landmark-based, but it's also driven by people's actual stories.
And so it takes how long to
90 minutes.
90 minutes.
And it's free for the public. It starts at Shawnee Mission East, and you drive through Prairie Village, Mission Hills, cross Ward Parkway, across onto the east side, and it gives you sort of a glimpse into the lives of people that have been impacted by these segregation practices.
And what's also involved with Race Project KC? What other parts of it are there?
So in addition to our Dividing Lines tour, we bring high school students together anywhere from 7 to 3 times in any given year. This year we had 2 cohorts, 7 total schools. We have workshops at the Nelson, the Napoleon exhibit. We talked about power and privilege and how that relates to present day. Health equity. So Wyandotte County did a study of what it means to be a pregnant woman in a D grade neighborhood versus an A grade. Students examine that. We've worked with Mecca, and we've had challenges to think through racism and how to dismantle it.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. What an interesting one it was, though. That was the voice of Angel Tucker with the Johnson County Public Library. Tanner Colby was here again. His book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, Olive Henry, a Shawnee Mission East junior who's been on the bus tour. Olive, you did a great job. Thanks for coming in here today. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Missouri's vanishing prairie. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Missouri was once home to a 15-million-acre sea of prairie. Today, not so much. Less than one-tenth of 1% remains, most of it in isolated tracts that landowners have preserved. There's a foundation in Missouri that works to preserve the prairie. The Missouri Prairie Foundation maintains more than 3,300 acres of prairie across the state. The State Conservation Department oversees some 60,000 acres, and that's mostly it. With us here to talk about the need to preserve the Missouri Prairie is Carol David. She's editor of the Missouri Prairie Journal and will be the opening keynote speaker at the North American Prairie Conference this June down in Texas. Carol, thanks for taking some time.
Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate being here.
You know, you're a tireless crusader for the Missouri Prairie. Why have you made it such an important part of your life?
Well, because prairie is such an important part of all of our lives, whether we realize it or not. As you mentioned, 15 million acres of prairie in Missouri prior to statehood, and we've lost a tremendous amount of that, as you noted. But we have reaped the benefits of prairie soils through becoming an agricultural powerhouse. You know, so much of the prairie was plowed for agriculture, which made the Midwest the agricultural engine that it is. And directly or indirectly, we very much depend on the resources of prairie that we've used for agriculture. It's a landscape of endless beauty, of endless surprise. There are many things about prairie that we're still learning, that we're still finding out about, despite the few remnants that we have left. But each one of them remains vital habitat and an inherent value that we must preserve and protect for our benefit and for the benefit of future generations.
I was going to say, what happens if we lose it all? What's the consequence?
I think it speaks to, if we were to lose it all, it would speak to our lack of will to protect something that has benefited us so much. We would be depriving future generations. We would not have the foresight. But the good thing is we do have many people with the foresight to protect it. Supporters of the Missouri Prairie Foundation and other individuals who support other conservation groups, there's a tremendous passion in our state to protect prairie. If we look, so that's sort of the philosophical way of looking at things. From a practical standpoint, we would lose soil resources. We would lose these pollinator reservoirs that prairies are. And these pollinators that live on our prairies, many of them pollinate our food crops as well. So there's a very direct economic link and link to our food security there as well. These prairies are part of our cultural history. They are part of our economic history. But despite their dramatic reduction in size, they remain vital habitat. They remain incredibly beautiful places for us to enjoy.
I was going to say, when you stand in one and you have a second to just enjoy it, what goes through your mind?
Well, on the one hand, it gives you a sense of peace where you feel rather small, which is actually a good feeling to have because it helps put our human place in perspective. What's really magical about prairie is you have this at once. You have two sensory things going on at once. You have this open sky. And then if you look down in a prairie, you see this infinite detail. So to have that sort of aesthetic contrast is really exhilarating. And that's what goes through my mind, even though I'm not necessarily conscious of it when I'm there, but reflecting on it, I think that is a great appeal aesthetically about prairie. And you're hearing all of these sounds. You're hearing grassland bird calls. You're hearing insects.
Right. You know, I thought this was interesting. You have said that you can replicate certain ecological functions of a prairie, but it's impossible to reconstruct all the interconnections. Can you explain that to me?
Yes. So there are many functions that a prairie provides for us. So, for example, you could have Blazing Star is a prairie wildflower that grows on original prairies, and that's something that all of us can plant. And it will attract pollinators, both on a prairie and probably wherever we plant it. That is an element of a prairie whose ecological function we can recreate by planting it. But there could be some pollinators that would come to that Blazing Star on an original prairie, but might not show up on that Blazing Star in your backyard that's far away from prairie. There are soil microorganisms that we are just beginning to learn about. And there was research done about several years ago in Colorado that showed that there was an entire phylum of bacteria in a prairie that then these researchers looked at cropped land that had previously been prairie, and that bacteria was missing. So there are things of this nature, things that we're just beginning to understand microbiotic level that I think would be incredibly difficult to replicate. But but let me say that, of course, we definitely do want to replicate it. We want to have prairie plantings wherever it makes ecological sense because of all of those functions that it provides for us. Another example would be the deep complex root systems of prairie plants. On prairies, those root systems are absorbing and filtering stormwater. That's an ecological function that these prairie remnants perform for us. We can replicate that function by planting prairie plants in another area, and they will absorb stormwater and store carbon. Those are ecological functions that we can replicate, and we must do that. But in terms of replicating every every organism and every ecological interactions, that is beyond human scope, I believe.
Do biologists have hope that maybe a century from now, assuming that Missouri continues to maintain these prairies, would that return? Is there any hope of that?
Well, in terms of our original prairie habitats, we can't simply set those aside and they're going to be preserved. Prairie evolved with certain disturbances like fire that must be applied to the landscape in order to perpetuate that prairie ecosystem. So we can never walk away even from these original habitats. And then in terms of other prairie coming back, I think that's only going to happen if we take the steps to make it happen. That is, we need to convert non-native landscapes to native planting. So humans are very important in this process. We have to safeguard these original prairie remnants, collect seeds from those remnants, and then use those seeds for prairie plantings to help expand prairie habitat. So we definitely have to be actively engaged.
I was going to say the Missouri Prairie Foundation, which you head, has had this accelerated spurt of prairie acquisitions in recent years. How much have you acquired?
Since 2014, we've acquired more original unplowed prairie than any other group in Missouri in that time frame. Certainly other groups own and manage prairie, but since 2014, you're correct, we have had this spurt of acquiring more. Part of that is due to the urgency. We simply must save every piece that we possibly can. So we own 3,300 acres. In total of properties that we've purchased since 1969 through December of 2018, since 2014, it's been roughly towards 1,000 acres, I believe. Between 500 and 1,000 acres since 2014.
And you have your eyes, I assume, on lots more remnants across the state?
we would love to protect as much prairie as we possibly can, and purchasing it, yes, absolutely, if when we have the means to do so, and we certainly invite supporters to help us make that a reality. We also would like to help support private prairie landowners who own prairie and wish to continue protecting it as part of their family legacy, and we are very appreciative and have high respect for those individuals in our state who have protected original prairie and who are creating prairie plantings. We certainly can't do it alone, and we work with many partners, federal and state agencies who protect prairie and individual private landowners. But definitely, yes, we would love to protect as much as we can and own as much as we can if we're able to do that.
I was going to say, is the state of Missouri involved in purchasing remnants? Are they one of the players in this?
Absolutely. The Missouri Department of Conservation owns many thousand acres of prairie, and we work with them regularly, partnering on a wide variety of conservation initiatives. And the Conservation Department recently purchased a tract of land in the greater Kansas City area that has about a 40-acre tract of original prairie on it. Hmm. And the Missouri Prairie Foundation will be managing that prairie portion of that property through a cooperative agreement. So that's just one of many examples of the way that we all work together. And Missouri has a wonderful reputation and track record of conservation partnerships. We're really known for that throughout the country. As I said, there's a very strong conservation ethic in our state, and the Missouri Prairie Foundation is very pleased and proud to be part of that community.
I was going to say, what's the nearest spot of prairie to the Kansas City area that the public can go and enjoy?
Sure. Right in the city limits of Kansas City, the Kansas City Parks and Recreation owns Jerry Smith Park, and it has prairie remnant on it. So that's right within the city limits.
Do you know where that is? I've never heard of Jerry Smith Park.
It's on the south, it's in the south part of the city, and
right.
There's a wonderful organization in Kansas City called Kansas City Wildlands that works to conserve these remnant communities, not just prairie, but glade and forest and other communities. So I encourage listeners to go to Kansas City Wildlands website, and there'll be maps and information for those sites. And then a bit farther, but still with close to Kansas City, the Missouri Prairie Foundation owns Snowball Hill Prairie in outside the town of Harrisonville. It's only mm-hmm. 35 miles south of downtown Kansas City.
Right.
We acquired this a few years ago with help from partners in the Kansas City area. Burroughs Audubon and Platt Land Trust were two important partners, and there were many individual donors who helped with this as well.
Are there walking trails there?
We will maintain a mowed path there. We mm-hmm. Like to have as least amount of disturbance as we can to these prairies, but we are working on a mowed path there, of maintaining a mowed path. Snowball Hill Prairie is about 22 acres of original remnant prairie, and what's really special about this spot is at the top of the property, at the top of the hill, really dry growing conditions. There's very interesting plants adapted to dry conditions. And then there are 70 feet of relief at this site. At the base of the hill, there are plants that require really moist growing conditions. And then we are reconstructing prairie, doing a prairie planting right next to that remnant of about 50 acres to expand the prairie habitat at the site.
I'm visiting with Carol David. She's editor of the Missouri Prairie Journal. We're talking about preserving remnants of prairie across the state of Missouri and how vital it is to our ecological futures here. I gather these tracts don't come available every day, or do you have a list of possible purchase sites on your plate right at the moment, Carol?
Well, that's correct. They don't become available for sale every day, but we certainly keep our eye out for properties and try to stay in touch with landowners who might be interested in selling. But yes, sometimes we might wait for some time, and then suddenly one might become available for sale. And of course, we can only do this with funds from our supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been fortunate in that regard.
How many groups like yours are there in Missouri, and is the Missouri Prairie Foundation the largest of the groups?
The Missouri Prairie Foundation is the only state-based organization that's a non-governmental organization that's devoted to purchasing prairie. There are other groups. There are other groups like the Ozark Regional Land Trust.
Right.
That both owns land and holds conservation easements on land, prairie, sometimes farmland, forest. So they're looking at, they have their own criteria, of course, of working to protect land, mostly in the Ozark region. Closer to Kansas City, there's the Platte Land Trust, which works to conserve open space and areas of conservation significance in the Kansas City region. And there are several on the Kansas side. I'm not as familiar with those, but there's the Grassland Heritage group as well that's working on the Kansas City side. And then, of course, there are national groups like the Nature, or global groups, I should say, like the Nature Conservancy.
I'm wondering what the ultimate goal here is, Carol. What would you like to see 50 years from now or 100 years from now?
I'd like to see a more mainstream conservation ethic in our state, in our country. I would love it 50 years from now when school children can name 50 plants where they live. I was just reading about how children can recognize corporate logos but can't identify 10 plants that grow in their region. So I'd like us to really embrace our prairie inheritance and be proud of it and understand that it is part of our lifeblood. So I would like us to all be conserving as much original habitat as we can in our state. And I would love for everyone to have the joy of using native prairie plants for landscaping, for example, and in parks and in corporate settings. So I'd really like us to be proud of our prairie and native plant, native habitat inheritance, and really embrace it and showcase it and make it part of our everyday lives.
Why has so much of the native prairie gone away? What happened?
Well, prairie, with its extensive and complex root system, created some of the richest soil on the planet. And so, of course, it was very good for agriculture. And, of course, we need food crops. We need agriculture. Absolutely, we do. So converting so much of those millions of acres of prairie to agriculture was one type of land conversion. But we've lost prairie to places where we live and where we work and roads where we travel. So we have converted through land conversion for various human pursuits. And like so many things, we're now realizing what's been lost. But there are ways, of course, to conserve original habitats, but then also incorporate those plants from prairie, for example, into row crop agriculture. There are researchers in Iowa that have shown that by incorporating or taking just 10% of a cropped area and creating strips of prairie plants, we can see up to 90% reduction in soil erosion, dramatic reduction in runoff of fertilizers and so forth. So there are ways to incorporate prairie plants into everything that we do. So the steps are conserve all those original irreplaceable habitats and then safeguard them, use their seed sources to create prairie plantings and use other native plants where as appropriate in the ways that we go about our lives.
Carol David, again, is editor of the Missouri Prairie Journal. Carol, thanks so much for your time and explaining why this is so important to all of us.